My initial thought was take the journalism idea and expand it. I wanted to do something that touched people. Somehow in the back of my mind, I didn't know how I could connect serving others with writing. And I loved writing. My teachers always told me I was a good writer.
Welcome to Be a Baller Podcast, where we discuss how to build a lifelong legacy. I'm your host, Coach Tim Brown. Today, we'll be talking about building a legacy in community service with our special guest, Sister Carol Ware. Today on the show, Carol will share her commitment to being a positive role model for women in community service and how impacting the next generation of serving leaders. Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited about this opportunity. You know, we've been together for a while at Second Baptist Church, and then you are a Cleveland native as well.
That's right,
so
absolutely.
Yeah, we had a lot of Cleveland folks on the show, you know, kind of partial to that. You know, you grew up in Cleveland during the, as we call it, the good old neighborhood days.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the village that raised you?
Sure. Coming up in Cleveland in the late 50s, early 60s was a time where people got together and the whole neighborhood was your family, no matter where it was. The house that we lived in when I was born was a two-family house, and everybody around us, all those neighbors, played a part in everybody's child's role. One of our neighbors didn't have any children, but he was very pivotal in mine and my cousins who lived in the same house. He played a lot of roles in our house. He was a positive role model outside of looking at just my dad. But everybody was there. My grandmothers, both of my grandmothers were around me. I spent time with both of them. My one grandmother lived actually in the same area where the school was. So when my parents had to go to work, I just came home from school and went to her house. So that was an automatic. So we had a relationship. And then, like I said, my friends that I grew up in, I still have some of those friends to this day. We had connections with all of our parents. All of our parents was everybody's parents.
Right.
That was normal.
Right. You know, I know you went to college and
yes,
you majored
sir.
In magazine, journalism, advertising.
Yes, sir.
What was your inspiration? Were you in the school newspaper at Kennedy?
I did do that. Okay. When I was at John F. Kennedy High School, I was on the newspaper. I was a part of our yearbook crew, just putting things together. But that really wasn't what drove me. I liked writing, but I also knew that there was more to it than that. My initial thought was take the journalism idea and expand it. I wanted to do something that touched people. Somehow in the back of my mind, I didn't know how I could connect serving others with writing. And I loved writing. My teachers always told me I was a good writer. So I wanted to do creative stuff. I didn't want to do news stuff. I didn't want to do the reporter. I didn't necessarily want to be on air doing the anchor program. But when I went to college, the vast program that Bowling Green had offered news editorial, magazine, PR. It had different aspects of journalism, and it was required that you touched all of that. So I had a chance to actually walk through it and live it. And after doing that, I found ways to combine all those skills. And later, after I graduated, it really made sense because I used all those skills in almost every job that I had down the road, even if it didn't look like what I thought it was going to look like.
Hey there, Clark Kellogg here. Building a legacy usually involves meeting the unique needs of others and being part of something bigger than yourself. That's why I love First Merchants Bank. First Merchants believes that helping communities prosper means more than just providing banking services. It means offering accessible financial education, expanded access to home ownership, and partnerships with local nonprofits to help raise up neighborhoods and lift families out of financial hardship. For resources and tools available to you, visit www.firstmerchants.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Speaking of that, can you talk about your career in broadcast and magazine journalism?
Sure. So my plan when I first approached my senior year, I had actually interviewed with a TV station in Cleveland, had been offered a position with the public relations office. It was just what I wanted, like the ideal job at the time. I also then had my first experience with real life, and the job offer was rescinded.
Oh, wow.
I later discovered it had nothing to do with my skill, but it had to do with some of the internal politics that was going on at the station. And someone else had been promised the job. that was mine. And that right. person didn't have skills. That person had no training, but that person knew the right person. Mm. So I ended up having to start from scratch, which was panic mode. Mm. Thank God I had a good relationship with my parents. And they said, don't sweat it. You're here at home with us. We're not putting you out on the street. We will support you. We'll find a way, which is how I ended up working with two small publications that were minority owned. So they didn't have a big budget. So my first job was actually $95 a week.
Wow.
But it gave me an opportunity to do the work with magazines that I had learned in class. I had to do the layout. This person had a magazine, but she didn't know how to put it together. She never had anyone who was trained to do that. So I was actually able to do layout. And we didn't have computers then. Mm. So I had to do it from scratch.
From scratch.
With, you know, by hand and everything. But while it didn't make a lot of money, but the experience was valuable. And later with another magazine, same process. And then with a minority-owned public relations firm. And that really helped me to get my feet wet and doing a little bit more. Because that PR person, while he had good skills, he had never had trained folks on his staff. And he hired me and another young lady with degrees in communications. We ran it. Mm-hmm. We ran the whole business. So I was an account, quote, executive and handled contracts with several banks. My largest one was with Cleveland Coca-Cola Bottling Company. Mm-hmm. And I did their internal newsletter at the time. But with that came an opportunity to merge two things that I love. I love sports. I'm a huge sports person. Actually played basketball and ran track. Oh, wow. So I had a real connection to sports. Always wanted to do something with sports. Right. I saw a way to connect sports with that writing piece. Well, it gave me a chance to plan some community events that Cleveland Coca-Cola Bottling wanted to do. And they wanted to do a one-on-one basketball tournament. And with that was a whole weekend of activities, and they would bring in celebrities,
right.
celebrity coaches and all kinds of things, players. And because we had the Cavaliers right there, we had right. Cavs all the time. We did stuff with the Cleveland Browns. Mm. Reggie Rucker was one of our constant guests. Yeah. We did a lot of things with those. So I had a chance to do all of that. That was like a dream job, mm-hmm. but it didn't pay. Mm-hmm. But I said to myself, I got to suck it up. Mm. It may not make a whole bunch of money, but it's going to give me the experience that I want and that I need. Right. And I really enjoyed it. I did it for 2 years. And when it was time to go, I actually took a job to move here to Columbus. Mm. And that was my eye opener because that was really my first time really on my own.
Right.
But I was glad I took the time to live life the way I did it. Mm. And things didn't come out like the roadmap that I thought I had planned. Right. But it happened and it worked out.
Right. You know, the Bible says that all things work together.
Absolutely.
You know, good. And God has a plan and all
and,
this.
And I learned early that whole piece about the plans I have for you.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand it growing up,
right.
but it all made sense because that was not my plan.
Right.
When I moved to Columbus, I said 5 years and I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been here 38.
Right. You know, knowing that you're a strong woman of faith, being a longtime member of Second Baptist mm-hmm. Church, can you talk about your faith journey growing up?
Sure. Come from a very close family, rooted and grounded in the church on both sides, both my mom's side and my dad's side. And actually, I grew up in the same church with both grandmothers. Mm. Both of them weren't married. My grandfathers weren't in my life at the time. But all of us were in one church. My one grandmother was the minister of music.
Mm.
She was an original member of an older music group that some older folks would recognize, the Wings Over Jordan, which
wow.
is a historical African-American choir that sang spirituals in the late 30s.
Mm.
And that was history making in itself. But she was the minister of music. So I learned early on, I sang in the choir. I directed the choir at age like 7. She started me doing all that early. But I also, you know, Bible study and doing all the little things that you do in church as a little kid.
Right.
It was normal. And I never saw it as punishment.
Mm.
It was good. So I grew up knowing that. And even when I went to college, we didn't have a lot of churches necessarily that were available to us, but we found ways to have spiritual connections while we were on campus. There was a chapel on campus and different groups would start and have services and we would pray. It didn't have to be an organized setting at the time, but I never lost sight of my relationship with God
because
mm-hmm. I knew that's what was going to get me through no matter what. And I learned that as a child and it just stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a problem.
You know, speaking of that, you're blessed mm-hmm. to have your mother just celebrate her 100th birthday and still with you. Can you talk about your relationship with her mm-hmm. and inspiration you get from her every day?
Sure. It's interesting. I've always felt I had a very close relationship with both my parents. Mm-hmm. I'm an only child. And I knew years ago I would be close to them. We would be friends, although I respected them as my parents. Yes. We had a positive relationship. And I was always sad when I heard other people talk about how they didn't get along with their mm-hmm. parents, because I couldn't imagine that. Right. When my father passed in 2014, it was a no-brainer for me. I told my mother, well, you'll be moving to Columbus with me. Case closed. And she just said, okay. And she's been here. When she first came here, she was 90 years old. And I said, okay, we'll do what we have to do. I made whatever accommodations. I actually made adjustments. I have a space for her in my family room. She has her own, all her bedroom furniture she had at home. I brought it there. I actually bought a sleep sofa so I could stay in that same space. I wasn't going to leave her down there by herself. Part of it is respect, but because I love my mother.
Yes.
And I thought that was important. And it was for people to say to me, and it was said, well, you're not going to put her in. There are a lot of nice homes. I said, no, if I can do this, if I can make sure I take care of her, I want her to know that she is loved and I'm here for her. I promised her. And I promised my dad, little did I know, the night before he passed, because he was not sick. We had had conversation. She had had a fall. She was in a hospital bed downstairs, and I would get both of them ready for bed, just like kids. And he and I would chit chat and talk. And the last thing he said to me was, take care of your mother. And the next morning he didn't wake up. And when I dealt with that experience, while shocked and yes, hurtful, I looked at him and I said, Dad, I got her. So for me, it's just what I'm supposed to do. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
You know, speaking of that closeness with mom and dad, what are some of those sayings that you remember or that they have ingrained in you?
Gosh, there's a lot of them. Just some of the little things is never forget where you came from. That's something that was important. Both of my parents believed in serving others, so I got that from them. Didn't recognize it at the time. My father's grandmother, back in the late 1800s, was actually friends with different people that we read about now. Mary McLeod Bethune was one of her friends. And so service and doing things for other people. So they always encouraged me to do that. They always told me to believe in myself. Don't let anybody run you over. And to be proud and to do my best. And those were little things. My father always talked about just because I was a girl didn't mean I couldn't do things. And I didn't understand what that meant as a kid. But as I grew up and I recognized, he was telling me already, you don't have to stay in one lane. A lot of people thought I was going into education because my entire family is full of educators. My dad was a principal. My mom, you know, taught. I have cousins and my grandmother was an educator. My uncles, everybody taught school. And everybody just assumed, oh, you'll go and major. And I'm like, no. And my parents were okay with that. They didn't dictate. They took me on college tours before college tours were popular. Both of them were graduates of HBCUs, and they thought it was, you know, a shame that nobody wanted to go to college. You ought to want to, and we're going to help you find a way to get there. So those are the things that just always stuck with me, to think positive.
Yeah, and speaking of that, you mentioned a little earlier you were an athlete back in the day.
Yeah, back in the day.
How was that basketball track experience?
Good, because back then, it started actually in elementary school, when that wasn't popular,
right.
especially then. And our gym teacher was actually a track person. So he built his girls' track team, which was unheard of in an elementary school at the time. There was only a couple schools in the city that had that. And there was one school who had it dominated. He said, oh, we got the talent. We can do this. And he built us up. Then we ended up winning what was then probably equivalent to the city league type for elementary school and qualified for junior AAU in New York. And I loved it. I didn't realize how much I loved it. But I was also excited because my dad was a track person. He ran track at East Tech in Cleveland and then at Morehouse. I ran track, did hurdles. I was mostly a sprinter, and then got into basketball in the junior high school and played for a while, played into high school, which was also interesting because back then, girls' sports, nobody even paid attention.
Nobody.
Nobody had a clue. But what was significant, my senior year at the athletic banquet, that was the first year the girls' team earned athletic letters because Title IX happened the year before. So we were the first girls' basketball team at John F. Kennedy High School to receive athletic letters.
Wow, that's awesome. So you were right there.
Right there.
Right there. You know, we know you're a member of a Delta Sigma Theta sorority and have held several local, regional, and national positions. Who are some of the ladies that encouraged you to be involved at that higher level?
It started really with my mom just telling me, the thing she said to me when I was initiated, there's more to Delta than what you see in front of you. That has taken on different meanings as I've been in the organization for 47 years now. But I knew that there was more for me to do, but I didn't know what that was. I never saw myself as the person in charge. I was just a worker. But I was exposed to people when I first got out of school and went back to Cleveland. The person who was the first committee that I worked on, the chairperson was Marcia Fudge. Marcia was a few years ahead of me. She graduated from Ohio State. But Marcia, we know now, is the secretary of HUD. She was also the 21st national president in Delta. Then as I came to Columbus and started working on programs and projects and co-chairing events in the chapter, trying to just be low-keyed, I had the blessing to work with several past presidents. They would come and speak for our luncheons. So one of the first people that I met was Hortense Kennedy, who was a past president so many people love. She was from Michigan, so she was in the region. And as we talked one day when she was coming for our luncheon, she said, you know, I see something in you. You should consider doing something outside of the chapter. And I just kind of like, yeah, okay, right. A couple years later, another now past national president, Bertha Roddy, came for Founders Day, spoke, and she pulled me aside. She said, I'd like to see you do some other things. And I just kind of ignored it. And then when she became president, she actually appointed me to my first national committee.
The team at the Financial Solutions Network is proud to partner with Tim Brown and bring you this episode of Be a Baller. Our mission is to share generously of our time, talent, and financial resources to help our clients develop financial plans and wealth management strategies that allow them to live the lives they imagine while connecting them with experiences and people that enhance their quality of life. FCA is one of those organizations by helping young men and women through the development of their personal faith. The Financial Solutions Network is an independently owned and managed wealth advisory firm based in Worthington, Ohio. We are a multi-generational professional team of advisors with a combined 83 years of experience teaching and managing financial strategies for individuals, families, businesses, and institutions. We would be honored to help you plan your financial journey. Contact us at 614-505-3025 or visit our website at tfsn.net.
And then it started from there. And then being on that national committee, being exposed to others. Then I would say Gwendolyn Boyd, I worked with her on some things, and she's a past national president now, former president of Alabama State. She, I mean, historical in her own right as a scientist, an engineer. So with that, I had connections with different people, and it just started to happen. And I started to see myself offering skills that I realized that I had. So I then had the nerve to run for a regional office, which in itself was a challenge. Yeah. But to be able to be elected regional director over 8 states at the time, we now have the province of Ontario, Canada. But at the time, it was 8 states with all those people. But I didn't fear it. I saw it as an opportunity, and I said, I have something to offer. And then later, because of all of that, then was appointed to national board positions, and that's it.
Awesome. As we think about sororities and fraternities, what does servanthood mean to you?
Servanthood to me is giving to others without looking for something in return. Servanthood comes from your heart. that you find it, the desire to actually give to someone and to do for someone and to be what someone may need, without saying, I'm going to get accolades. Mm. It's not about you. It's about others. And when I look at what we learn as children, even growing up, and what God would want us to do, that's a part of what I see in that servanthood. God doesn't do things for us to get recognized. Mm. Why should we? So servanthood for me is just giving of yourself to serve others without expecting anything back.
Mm. Well, that's great. That's a great answer. That's really what servanthood is. Not expecting anything back.
Absolutely.
You know, just here to serve. Mm-hmm. And I've watched that in you. I actually at church, you know, just watching mm-hmm. you maneuver around, you know, being real low key. But just like those other mm-hmm. ladies, there was something about it. You know, there was something there, you know. But it's just the way you know, just the way it was. You know, and after 30 years in state government, you retired from the Ohio Department of Medicare, mm-hmm. where you were a health equity administrator mm-hmm. and served on Ohio Commission on Minority Health for several years. The question mm-hmm. is, I've been an advocate for minorities. Why was that fight so important to you?
I was blessed to see some things from afar and mm. kind of put the puzzle pieces together. Mm. Even back when I was with the PR firm in Cleveland and working with Cuyahoga County Children's Services, we led a program that was then very unique, an outreach program for foster care and adoption, trying to focus on getting more minority parents, because I learned there are a lot of minority children who weren't being adopted or being put in foster care with people who looked like them. Mm-hmm. And part of it was an education that needed to happen in our community. So I learned that early on. Mm. I ended up coming to Columbus because of a job opportunity and ended up with the state level Department of Child and Family Services because they wanted to mimic the program we did, which was then One Church, One Child, that started in Illinois.
Okay.
And we put that together in Cleveland.
Okay.
So that started it. So that got me to do more research, pay attention. And when I saw what was happening with that, I began to see other differences in healthcare. But because I didn't work directly with it, that was kind of on the back burner. I later got invited to a position in the Medicaid department, which was still then under the Department of Job and Family Services. Mm. So I led children's health and prenatal care programs for the state of Ohio. That was my role as a section area. And after working with that, doing the research, working with medical professionals, had to do a little education, a little mini med school on my own, because I was dealing with medical providers all the time. I learned that there were some differences, even in how, and with my marketing background, we get the word out. We want more people to get their prenatal care early, get their children in for their exams. But the message had to be different because we're talking with different populations. Mm. I understood that from a communications background, but everybody else didn't. So I had to share that. So when I kept doing all that, I spent almost 18 years doing the management of those programs. I started working more with the commission at one point. And as I did that and I saw there's disparities, things aren't the same. Mm. And we started looking at data, national data, because Ohio didn't have a lot of data at the time. And we talked about the fact that there's some things that we don't recognize in healthcare, the delivery of services, the access to services, how people perceive their service providers, how those providers perceive them. Mm. It was a lot of information out there, but nobody wanted to talk about it. It wasn't comfortable. And I remember talking to a chief at the time in 2008, and I shared with him that there's some serious deficiencies in healthcare when we talk about minority populations. We need to track the data here in Ohio to make sure we're on target because we might be missing some things. Right. And other states are starting to do this. And the response I got at the time, that person said to me, well, where does it say we have to do this?
Whoa.
I said, so you have to be told to do data collection on a certain population, but you didn't ask that question for others. So why don't we? So in 2010, when the Affordable Care Act came, and there's language in that, I marched back in there to him and said, here's where it says you have to do this.
Right.
And we started collecting the data. Well, by that time, Medicaid had become its own department. It was no longer a part of Job and Family Services. And as they were trying to configure certain roles and responsibilities, there was finally an acknowledgement that they need to make health equity a priority. So they created a position as health equity administrator, and that became me.
Hmm.
Wow. Now, of course, the sad part was there was no money with it. Okay. There was no staff with okay. it. But I was health equity, but I was okay to do what I right. could do. But right. I had served on the commission representing the agency for 8 years. And so I got directly involved and had a chance to work with fabulous staff from the health department, Chip Allen and Angela Dawson, who is the executive director of the commission. And the three of us actually put together a team. And we did the work to make sure that Ohio was one of the first states to actually put language in contracts with the health plans that we worked with to provide care for Medicaid folks, that they were going to track and actually make health equity a priority. And it's in language in the contracts. That hadn't happened in a lot of states. And we ended up going around the country doing workshops, sharing how we came together and collaborated to create that. So
your conversation here is why I do this podcast. People just don't know. You know, they see people, but they really don't know the story. Mm-hmm. And then we see things happen and we don't know how they happen. Mm-hmm. Especially young people, they think stuff just happens.
It just happens.
You know, it doesn't just happen. You know? Somebody had to be at that table, not just a pound in the table.
And it's tough because when the pandemic first hit, and if you think back on the news reports we were hearing, and all of a sudden the talk was about the number of minorities who were dying.
Yes.
And the whys, the whole issue. And all of a sudden we start hearing conversations about, well, they're more prone to certain diseases. We shared all that. I still have data from reports I put together in 2005 and six that said that exact same thing, but nobody wanted to hear that. And so now, unfortunately, we've lost lives, but now everybody recognizes, right. Oh, so this really was a problem.
Right. God has his way.
He has
his
way.
Getting everybody's attention. Mm-hmm. You mentioned about your mom and dad being HBCU graduates, and I'm reading your bio. I know you do a lot of work with United Negro College Fund. Mm-hmm. Can you tell the audience why education, and particularly UNCA, is so important to you?
Like I said, growing up in a family of educators, my mother went to Bluefield State College in Bluefield, West Virginia first, and then transferred and graduated from West Virginia State and Institute. My father's a Morehouse man. Blessed to have been there with some names that people kind of recognize, like Martin Luther King. Yeah. They were classmates. Yeah. And Lerone Bennett, who was an editor that many people knew and a historian. Mm-hmm. They were roommates. So those kind of folks, having those and hearing them talk about their experience, college was a no-brainer. But I also had relatives in the family who also went to West Virginia State. Some went to Miles College. We had a lot of folks who went to school. So I saw there was, you know, the focus on education. And I know my parents talked strongly about their experience, of course, thinking back into what years those were. They saw love and support with UNCF, with the colleges that make up now the UNCF. And when I saw that, I said, okay, so I didn't go. I went to a predominantly white university, but that didn't mean I can't give back to schools that benefit primarily students that look like me. Yeah. So I started working before I moved here with the UNCF in Cleveland. And that was a way to be able to give back. I know my parents still contributed to their alma maters. Mm-hmm. Other friends of ours who went to other schools, and I began to know those, the Central State folks, the folks who went to Alabama State. Mm-hmm. My dad actually took some courses at Alabama State when he was, because he had a physics and math degree and he wanted to teach, so he had to take some education courses. He took them at Alabama State. So that connection told me that this is important and we need to honor education and make it positive. Even if everybody doesn't think they can go, we need to put it out there to make it say, maybe you might want to consider it, find a way. So that's why for all these years, I've done as much as I could to help. And we do now at Second, one of the things we do every year, we started six years ago, Celebrate Education Sunday. Mm-hmm. And we come to church with our various school shirts on and we make it a big deal and we tie it into our team with the UNCF walk. And we've been blessed 3 years in a row to have won the mayor's trophy for our efforts in raising funds to get people in college.
Right. I like that Education Sunday. You know, for young people, you can't be what you don't see.
That's right.
And being seeing people, and as you mentioned about your dad being there, it comes real to him, you know. It's just kind of made up, you know.
Right. He shared a lot, and I value even more now as an adult the stories they would tell.
Yeah.
And I had a chance, we would go back, and they would, you know, visit some of their friends, and we would go back to Atlanta, and I had a chance to meet people who now I've read their names in books and things, and I've had a chance to meet those people. And know that they had relationships, but I heard their stories. Mm-hmm. When I met Benjamin Mays, who was the president mm-hmm. of Morehouse when they were in school, mm-hmm. and I actually had a chance to meet wow. him, and I was like, wow, okay. And I knew the stories. I have his books, mm-hmm. and I saw the things and the lessons that were learned. So this is something we need to value.
Amen. Amen. You know, this broadcast is about legacy. Mm-hmm. What does that word legacy mean to you?
Legacy to me is providing a foundation for someone to build on, something to leave for those who come behind you. You may not know who they are, but if you can leave something that they can learn from, grow from, refer to, help them see themselves maybe in a different light. Legacy means you've left something behind that something someone will value. I remember when I look at things, you know, my mom used to always tell me things. You never know what someone has gone through, but when they can tell you the story, you may learn from it way down the road.
Way down the road.
Way down the road. So I look at those kinds of stories, yeah. and I think that's what it is. I look at my family members. I look at friends of our family who I think have left legacy in different ways, because it's going to look different for everybody.
Yes, yes.
And I think for me, it's just doing the best I can to be of service and, you know, make sure that someone benefits, mm-hmm. someone grows from it, and that I can feel good knowing that I've been able to make an impact.
That impact. Amen. You know, this has been a great conversation.
I enjoy
as
it.
We turn the corner. Mm-hmm. You have a true servant's heart. Mm-hmm. Now, what is it about Carol World that keeps you serving the community and helping others reach their potential? What is that inside of you that says, hey, I want to help this person?
I think it's just in my blood because I've done it naturally. Sometimes yeah. I'm not even aware I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. It's automatic for me. Mm-hmm. When I retired, you know, my initial vision of retirement was to go and consult and do some things. But obviously, because we know God has his own plan. Yeah. And when I ended up being permanent caregiver for my mom, mm-hmm. even though 10 years ago she was in a little bit better state, she didn't have the dementia and she was a little bit, you know, more agile. But I knew I had a responsibility, so I couldn't do all of those things, but I was trying to find ways to stay connected so I could continue to serve. And while there was a challenge with the pandemic, one of the blessings was technology. When we had Zoom,
yes,
I could still be on meetings. I could still participate. And I looked for that. It gave me an outlet. It was kind of what gave me some energy to know that I could still offer my service through different vehicles. It may not look the way we've always done it,
right.
but it helped me think that big picture of sometimes we have to change how mm-hmm. we approach something mm-hmm. and still be able to make a difference. Yeah. So it's just in me. I enjoy it. I just do it automatically.
Well, I want to thank you for
being that
model, that role model of a couple of things. One is definitely of excellence.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like I said, I observe you, and I know everything you've done from singing in the choir, from everything has been of excellence,
mm-hmm.
you know, being that model for young people about how to do things the right way. And then doing it in the right spirit.
Mm-hmm.
There's not, like you say, a legacy or just serving, not looking to get anything back. It's mm-hmm. just what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Just what I do. And I'm glad you're able to share your story about your parents and mm-hmm. grandparents and just all that's inside of us.
Absolutely.
You know? And God has a way of getting it out of us.
Absolutely.
You know? We can't run from it.
You know? Thank you for this opportunity to do that.
It's been a blessing. And I'm so glad that you made your way to Columbus.
Yeah, it worked out.
You made your way here. And this city has truly been blessed.
Well, thank you.
So as we end this broadcast, I want to thank the audience for listening to this Be a Baller podcast and our special guest, Carol Ware. And as always, continue to listen to the podcast.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share this podcast with family and friends. Be a Baller podcast is available on all major podcast stations. Be sure to come back next week as we continue to discuss on how to build a lifelong legacy. Until then, don't forget to be a baller. This podcast was created by Coach Tim Brown. It was edited by Tehran Howe and produced and recorded by the video production class of Worthington Christian High School.